April 7th, Monday, April 7th, 2008. It is 2:20 in the afternoon of that same day. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here. Senator Huggins is here. Senator Wilikowski and myself, Senator French. We have many bills up today, and I'd like to hear a couple that have been in the committee for a long time and move them. And so let's start with HB 25. HB 25 comes to you today in the form of a CS. If there could be a motion to adopt the CS, I'll then object and we'll go through the changes.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that we adopt the CS version backslash C.
I'm going to object for the purposes of discussion. You should have a backslash C before you that makes one, two, three changes, and then I'll explain the rest of it. On page one of the CS before you, we took out the phrase directly or indirectly from line 10, I'm sorry, after the word that, since the bill now requires that landlords directly allow the use of their property through the filing of an easement. And so there's no need to have the words directly or indirectly. That's change one. On page two at lines 7 and 8, a change was made to add a new subsection B to clarify that improved land does not include buildings, structures, machinery, or equipment. And that's change number two. Finally, new sections 2, 3, and 4 were added to outline a procedure for recording easements for use by the public of these lands, outlining the information to be contained and providing that no recording fee will be charged for these filings. It's going to be free, since the landowner is graciously allowing the public to use their property for free. They'll file a simple easement that we actually, I'll explain. Chairman worked with the recorder's office to find out how hard it'd be to file an easement, and it was simple. I filed one in plain English. They sent it back to me with like two changes, and so through that activity, and then working with the sponsors, we came up with these three changes, which I believe the sponsor is going to support. If you come forward, put yourself on the record, and welcome to the committee.
Katie Schau, staff to Representative Paul Seaton, and Representative Seaton would like to thank you and your staff for all the time that you've spent working on this legislation, and Representative Seaton is supportive of these changes.
Thank you. Any other comments about the CS before us? There are two other matters, so I'm going to remove my objection at this point to the adoption of the CS. Is there further objection? Hearing and seeing none, the CS is before us. There are two other matters for the committee to be aware of. The first is a letter of intent that you have in your packets. The letter of intent states that it is the intent of the legislature that the public be provided with this sample language for drafting an easement to the public. And the letter goes on to provide some sample language so that people know how to do this. When they're going to grant the free use to the public of a certain portion of their land, they get in exchange a better liability. An enhanced, it requires then gross negligence for them to be found liable for bad things that happen on their property. It's the negotiation and a compromise. So that's the letter of intent. We'll have to move that when the...
Do we have to adopt that?
Would there be a motion to adopt the letter?
So moved.
Is there objection to the adoption of the letter of intent? Hearing and seeing none, the letter has now been adopted. Finally, there'll be a title change, a concurrent resolution leaving here with the committee to reflect that there shall be no fees required by the recorder's office for the filing of these easements. Normally there's a $25 fee for filing a document with the recorder's office, but that's going to be waived in this instance. So that's the third change that we took up. The CS is now before us. The title change has been adopted. Is there further committee discussion on House Bill number 25? Is there a motion? Mr. Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that we pass CS for House Bill number 25 backslash C out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved out of committee.
Yes. Would you like me to make a title change resolution?
Please.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move a conforming title change amendment to reflect the changes made in the CS for House Bill number 25 out of Judiciary.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the title change resolution is moved. Thank you, Senator McGuire. Next up is House Bill 196. And I see the prime sponsor and his able staff, Ms. Pearson, here. Welcome to the committee, Representative Ramirez. Ms. Pearson, good afternoon. Please put yourselves on the record and tell us what we need to know about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's a privilege to be here. House Bill 196 has evolved into a terrific piece of legislation that encompasses two significant pieces, and I'm going to have Jane Pearson take you through it. But, Mr. Chairman, the two pieces are an update of wills and the statutes that surround that subject, and the second one is anatomical gifts, which is speaks for itself and is a very worthy subject to be included in this day and age when a person contemplates what to do with the things that are in their possession. I think I'm trying to state it tactfully.
I thought you said it very well. Ms. Pearson, welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Ramirez and the House Judiciary Committee. And this bill, as Jay said, breaks into two different points. Parts, the estate portion of House Bill 196 are sections 1 through 5 of the bill and section 37. And it provides for three things. It provides a penalty clause for contesting a will or instituting other proceedings. It applies even if probable cause exists for instituting the proceedings, and this will align wills with similar provisions in revocable trusts. It amends Alaska Statute 1316-680A to change the statement in an affidavit to be used by a decedent's successor to collect personal property in a small estate. The statement is that the estate does not consist of vehicles worth more than $100,000 or personal property worth more than $100,000. This bill also lays out protections for benefits paid under life insurance and retirement plans. There was one issue that was brought to the sponsor's attention by the attorneys who have been working on this bill, which the committee might wish to consider. It's in section 2 on page 2, line 10. It reads that a small estate can be passed to a successor via an affidavit if the personal property is valued at less than $100,000. This was amended in Senate Labor and Commerce. The bill was originally written at $25,000, and it is currently in statute at $15,000. The attorneys believe that $50,000 would be more in line with Alaska's other statute on small estate administration, which allows a very short probate if the estate is less than $55,000, assuming there is a spouse and or minor children.
And on that point, Representative Ramirez, on that point, Mr. Chairman, those concerns were brought to our attention in Senate Labor and Commerce by Senator Bundy, and we have had a very accommodating dialogue on the subject. So at his request, the figure was taken up to $100,000. That was, I believe, a recommendation. Not so?
The trust attorneys this is Jane Pearson for the record, the trust attorneys that we have been working with believe that this may be a problem, because what it would do is, if you had two successors of interest, if you had the good son and the bad son could basically write an affidavit that he was the successor in interest and take the $100,000 out of the estate, and it's a rather large sum of money that could never be recouped. But, you know.
On that point, we worked with the senator, and the determination was made that it wasn't necessarily in the best interest of the heirs, and in working with the attorneys, we've come to an accommodation that we think is more fair to heirs and successors.
What is that?
And that accommodation is?
What Jane just explained, that we
Want figure
the
$50,000
to roll it back, Mr. Chairman, back to $50,000 through amendment.
I'm going to flag that as a point for further discussion by the committee. Once we hear an overview of the bill, we'll turn to some. We've got at least two, it looks like two. We've got the bill is an amalgamation of your trust principles and other, and then principles that relate to anatomical gifts. So we've got medical witnesses, Dr. Jay Butler, and it looks like Bruce Zalneritis, And then we also have trust attorneys Robert Manley, Robert Gleeden, and Mike Garrity. So we'll direct our queries to those two groups as necessary. So thank you for flagging that. Please proceed.
The balance of the bill clarifies and updates statutes dealing with anatomical gifts. The anatomical gifts portion of the bill was drafted in cooperation with the Department of Law, the Department of Health and Social Services, the State Medical Examiner's Office, Life Alaska Donor Service, and with representatives from the National Conference on Commissioners on Uniform State Laws to ensure a sound piece of legislation. These provisions are drawn from the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, UAGA, which is aimed to harmonize anatomical gift laws in all 50 states and has been in place for over 40 years. Paralyzing the UAGA, HB 196 aims to facilitate organ and tissue donation and transplants, removes obstacles in the donation process, and hopefully will increase participation in organ donation donor programs. There have been significant technological and methodological changes in donation and transplantation field over the years, and this bill would bring Alaska into sync with these changes. Alaskans have shown impressive numbers in their willingness to participate in organ and tissue donation programs. Over 330,000 Alaskans, or close to 30% of the state's population, participate in the Alaska Donor Registry Program. 800 to 1,000 new registrants are added each week, but there is more that can be done. Right now in Alaska, there are 180 patients that are waiting for life-saving transplants, and many more that are waiting for tissue transplants. By improving the anatomical gift laws in Alaska, this bill encourages and facilitates badly needed organ donations that will save and improve lives all over the state and throughout the country.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Representative Ramirez.
Thank you. And on that point, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we heard compelling testimony in House Judiciary that in spite of the strides that Providence is making in the Anchorage area, and other hospitals like Fairbanks Memorial in my community, we presently do not have the breadth of services available to do anything but harvest organs in the state of Alaska, and so consequently, either Alaskans or beneficiaries of organ donors in the Pacific Northwest. Those Alaskan organs or those Alaskan beneficiaries of organs, it's an intrastate compact, thank you. And so it's very important that we update the laws on organ donations so that we don't find ourselves out of sync. As you'll hear from some testimony, time is of the essence. When it comes to keeping various organs and tissue alive to facilitate this great gift of life. One of the witnesses that we heard from was a mother of a young person, and her child that passed away, 48 or 49 people have been the beneficiary of the tissue from that person. So it's very critical that we continue to update in this particular area to maintain this life-giving, life-extending. It's a delicate subject, so I don't want to pick my words incorrectly. The testimony is compelling. The subject is very serious. It's important that the state of Alaska conform with other states so that we can continue to facilitate this life-giving service. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ramirez. Other questions for either the prime sponsor or Ms. Pearson? Senator Theriault, and welcome to the committee. The record should reflect that Senator Theriault joined us some minutes ago.
Has the section of the bar that they've got little subcommittees that deal with this area, not specifically anatomical gifts, but wills and probate, have they weighed in on this at all?
Senator Theriault, through the chair, yes, it has been vetted through them.
Thank you.
Other questions for the bill sponsor or Ms. Pearson. Hearing and seeing none, let's turn to, we have Robert Manley and Rodney Cleeden on the phone. I hope I've pronounced your names correctly.
Yes, thank you, Senator French.
And you're here on the trust provisions, is that correct?
That's correct.
Let's turn to those. I think I asked this question in the last committee, but I'm still a little fuzzy on it, and that's with respect to Section 1. Section 1 seems to take current law and, in essence, flip it around and change the ability of a person to challenge a will. The law used to read that a provision in a will purporting to penalize an interested person for contesting the will or instituting other proceedings relating to the estate is unenforceable if probable cause exists for instituting proceedings, thus sort of letting someone challenge a will, or at least not be penalized for challenging the will, as long as there's probable cause, which I've got to believe that a judge would make that finding. Now we're going to say that that penalty clause is in effect and enforceable even if probable cause exists for instituting proceedings. Maybe one of the two of you can explain to me whether, is this a huge change? Is this the becoming the majority rule? This strikes me as being a topic that's bound to be debated amongst probate attorneys. Maybe you can give me some flavor of that debate.
Yes, thank you, Chairman French. My name is Robert Manley. I've practiced law in the estate planning and probate area for more than 30 years. I'm part of the informal group of estate planning attorneys who work on keeping the Alaska Law of Trusts current and working efficiently so Alaskans can have their wishes implemented with a minimum of expense and tax costs. Now, as to Section 1, what it does, it brings the law governing wills in conformity with the current law governing revocable trusts. Now, wills and revocable trusts are the two primary vehicles for estate planning. There are various reasons for selecting one over the other, including the expense of drafting and the expense of implementing those plans, privacy regarding dispositions, and avoidance of probate in multiple jurisdictions. Currently, the trust law provides that a no-contest clause is effective, regardless of probable cause for bringing on a challenge to the trust.
And Mr. Manley, let me stop you and just ask you there, is that a uniform provision? Is that the majority rule that, with respect to trusts at least, you cannot institute proceedings challenging it penalty-free if that clause is in the trust?
From a statutory point of view, I think it's the minority rule and probably the minority rule from a general judicial point of view where the issue isn't addressed specifically by the statutes.
Okay, thank you. And then now turn to the will side of the equation.
And the will side of the equation provides that if there's a no contest clause, if there is probable cause to bring the contest, then the penalty set forth in the no contest clause would not be effective or enforceable. But let me explain exactly what a no contest clause is. A no contest clause simply indicates that here, beneficiary, I am providing you something under my will or trust. However, if you object to my gifts, my other gifts, or other provisions, then you are at risk for losing the gift I am giving you. For example, if a decedent wanted to favor his children and his stepchildren equally, in the absence of a no-contest clause that was effective, the children who would be otherwise more greatly benefited if the will was ineffective could challenge the capacity of the individual making the will without any risk of loss. And unfortunately, what happens is people sometimes have very good reasons for excluding or favoring some portion of their family over other portions of their family, or perhaps even providing for charity rather than directly for their family. And without this provision, it makes it all too easy for the disappointed shirt-tail relatives or others to leverage the risk of litigation and the potential challenge and extract some sort of settlement on that basis. Now, this does not apply or isn't effective as to spouses because we have other provisions protecting the right of spouses, but it does apply to children, shirt-tail relatives, and the like. Now, if there's a genuine case of undue influence, then the no contest clause is ineffective because the entire instrument is ineffective. But this is simply a way to allow testators to preserve their plan. Now, as to the trust provision, one of the reasons that the trust provision was provided was in part to make Alaska a more trust-friendly situs for administration. We've been working over the last 10 years to make Alaska a little like Delaware is for corporations, the favored jurisdiction to maintain these trusts. And that's one reason why the no contest clause provision was added into trusts. This is simply a way to bring our laws governing wills into conformity with the laws governing trusts and allow people to do with the simpler, less expensive wills what they could do with trusts.
And I guess that's the source of my concern, Mr. Manley. I think of trusts and as belonging to a more sophisticated class of testators, for lack of a better word, and wills not. Wills pertaining to something that, the most folks go out and maybe do it yourself or get some help from a lawyer, but falling on the lower end of the sophistication scale. This statute, I'm going to guess, has been on the books for a long, long time, and I see probable cause as being sort of the barrier to bad challenges. If you have probable cause to challenge a will, should you really be penalized for doing so? Because, you know, we all think we know what the testator wants, but maybe you don't. And if you don't, and if someone doesn't challenge it because they're going to get penalized for doing so, you could just as easily reach a bad result. And if you didn't answer my question, let me just pose it again. How many jurisdictions do you think have a clause like the one that you're proposing or it's being proposed here in Section 1?
I don't know. I haven't done a count. I can certainly follow up and send an email to all committee members on the subject, but I don't know right now.
That's important to me. I know that we've adopted an aggressive sort of trust set of trust laws, but again, I think people stepping into that milieu, the reason we've done that is so we can attract investors from across the country, and they tend to be people with high net worth. That's some of the testimony I recall from earlier proceedings, and so I expect that they get in with eyes wide open. And this, I've just had a lingering concern about this provision. Let's turn to
Senator French, if I may.
Please.
A couple observations. One, if we don't bring the law of trust into and wills into conformity, then you're allowing the person wishing to provide for a no contest clause to do so if they'll just spend a little more money on the lawyers. And that doesn't seem reasonable to deny that ability to, as you say, perhaps the less sophisticated people. And I also think that how do we really know what the testator or the decedent wants to do? Well, usually we do have a pretty good indication of what they want to do because that's what's in their trust or in their will. And what anyone challenging that is trying to do is trying to defeat their intent, not, I think, figure out their intent. Thank you, Senator.
Those are good points all, and I guess it's somewhat weak to just go out and count jurisdictions and make a decision that way, but I guess at some level I need to know how prevalent this provision is in trust or will law across the country.
Okay, certainly. I will commit to get the committee members an email count based on my research, and I hope by the end of the day.
We'll look for that. Senator McGuire has a question.
Well, and on that point, I'm thinking back to trust and estates and remembering some of the, you know, cases that come before you in the form of a textbook. And you do have situations where people are under duress. You do have situations where people have suffer from dementia. They've gone down different paths that lead to absurd results. And so I completely respect the right of an individual to leave in their will what they would like to whomever they would like. But I think there's a healthy tension that exists in the current law that allows people to challenge. And I'd hate to quash or chill healthy debate on a will.
It's a touchy and thorny question. Further debate on this section. Let's turn to section two, and we have some suggestion. Let me just make clear that the suggestion pertains to sub B and not sub A. Is that right, Ms. Pearson?
Yes.
And this, the effect of this is to allow a person to use, in essence, an affidavit to pass their belongings.
Senator French, that is true, and that is already in statute.
And in essence, you can use an affidavit. It had said in the past you can use your affidavit if your entire estate was less than $15,000. We're now bumping that up to say you can use vehicles less than $100,000, and then you're suggesting the personal property other than vehicles that does not exceed, and I think $50,000 was the suggestion. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator French.
And maybe just for the record, explain why we're keeping the vehicle, because that's a lot of vehicles, and personal property down lower. Representative Ramos.
Mr. Chairman, motorhomes.
Okay.
A lot of motorhomes and campers. And
we want them to go by affidavit.
I'm not quite certain. I was just trying to think.
Sorry. It was a good try, but I think a lot of us are a little strained at the moment.
Senator French, vehicles are also titled. They are not going to be dissipated. They're actually titled vehicles.
I see.
So
I see.
There's
a good registration on them. They're less portable, more quantifiable, not subject to fast maneuvering. Fair enough. And so I think at this point I'm going to move that on page 2, line 10, we take the figure $100,000 and strike that and put in its place $50,000. I'm going to move that. It's amendment number 1. Is there objection to amendment number 1? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to object just for purposes of discussion. You may or may not know this, Jane, but do you know what year the underlying statute was crafted in that came to the $15,000 figure? Because my thought was just simply cost of living adjustment, where are we now, and what was the intent at the time?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, I'm not exactly sure, but I believe it was in the 60s.
Excuse me, this is Robert Manley. Through the chair, may I address the question?
Yes, please, Mr. Manley, thank you.
It was 1984.
84.
In 1962, it was $6,000 and then adjusted to $15,000 in 1984.
So 25 years, you could easily see things having doubled 25 years or maybe a little more. So 50's not out of reach. Senator McGuire, further, you want to make an amendment to the amendment? Or?
No, I'm going to remove my objection. I think this is a good provision. Probate is a really, really difficult, onerous thing for people to go through. And if there's a way around it when you've got that small of a level of assets, I think it's good. So I remove my objection.
Further objection? Hearing and seeing that amendment number 1 is adopted. Let's turn now to the anatomical gift portions, which I believe begin at Section 5. Is that correct? And then go on to the rest of the bill. And we've got Mike Garrity on from the Uniform Law Commission. Mr. Garrity, I assume you're up to speed on these anatomical gifts?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Mr. Garrity. Can you hear me?
Is it Mitch?
Mike Garrity, I'm sorry.
Mr. Garrity. I'll just call you Mr. Garrity, then I'll be right. Go ahead and put yourself on the record, tell us who you represent, and then maybe tell us a little bit about the anatomical gift provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Garrity. I'm an attorney in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm also a state law commissioner from Alaska to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. The National Conference is tasked with evaluating the need for uniform laws on a variety of subject matters and topics, and then drafting appropriate uniform legislation for consideration by the 50 states once the determination is made that a uniform law would be beneficial. One such area is organ donation. And just to put this in context, I think the original Uniform Anatomical Gift Act was promulgated by the National Conference in 1968 and was quickly enacted by all 50 states and the District of Columbia. In 1987, there were some revisions, minor revisions, that were promulgated but adopted in only 26 states. The current revisions, which are in HB 196, drawn 38 years of experience with the original Uniform Act, and it brings it up to date with advances in medical technology, the widespread use of electronic records, and evolving practices in transplantation. HB 196 is the revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which was just promulgated by the National Conference in 2006. It has already been adopted in over 20 states, and momentum is growing to have it enacted in all jurisdictions in the next year or two. As legislators, I'm sure you can appreciate that with this revised act that was just promulgated in 2006, to have it already adopted in over 20 states says a great deal about the merits of this legislation that are before you in HB 196. The point has already been made about, I think, the importance of uniformity in dealing with gifts. It's very, very common for the decedent to be in one state, the donor to be in another state, and the donor's family may yet be in another state. And so this is an area where uniformity has always been critical. To summarize, basically, the changes are in this revised act. The first person consent to make a donation of an individual's organs, eyes, and tissues has been substantially strengthened to bar others from amending or revoking that gift that has been made by the donor. Likewise, a person who has refused to make a gift and has made that refusal known, conversely, the act strengthens that decision and prevents others from interfering with it as well. Absent first-person consent, gifts by family members and agents are facilitated in this new legislation if the deceased has not acted to make or refused to make an anatomical gift. This is done, for example, by expanding the roster of people who can make a gift on that person's behalf to include a healthcare agent, for instance, a grandchild or some other family member who's exhibited special care. And it also clarifies the manner in which the consent may be and must be obtained in those circumstances. Gifts on donor registries and state-issued identification cards are specifically authorized under this revised act, HB 196. And registries are encouraged and standards are provided for their operation in HB 196. Many states did not have donor registries when the original act was adopted. As it was mentioned, Alaska did pass a donor registry, which is done in connection with DMV several years ago, and it's been very, very successful by any standard. Finally, the new act provides for the cooperation and coordination between procurement organizations and medical examiners, particularly with regard to the procurement of donors and tissues from organs and then tissue from donors who are under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner. And we conferred closely with Dr. Butler and Dr. Falico here in Anchorage to go over all those changes and made some minor tweaks at their suggestion to make sure they were comfortable with everything. But again, the goal is to, where possible, expand the opportunities for gifts of organs and tissue to be taken from donors. Finally, I just conclude this HB 196. Well, let me see, the Revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which is embodied in HB 196, has been endorsed by the American Medical Society, the American Bar Association, the American Academy of Ophthalmology, the American Association of Tissue Banks, the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery, the Association of Organ Procurement Organizations, the Federal Health and Human Services Advisory Committee on Organ Transplantation, the Cornea Society, and the iBank Association of America. I know we're at the 11th hour with the current session of the legislature, but I'd strongly encourage the committee to act on this bill, and so we can join the other states who have adopted the Revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Mr. Garrity, it sounds like you've got the doctors and the lawyers in agreement about this bill.
That's right, yes.
It's making some people here nervous, but it gives me some comfort. Thank you. It looks to me like the model provisions begin around Section 18 and go on for several sections. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the tweaks you mentioned that Drs. Falico and Page were in on are the preceding sections where they're inserting statutory references in our statutes to those model provisions. Is that right?
Well, let me find that specifically. I'm
beginning with Section 6, which, you know, takes up a DMV statute.
What page are you on there, if I may ask?
I'm on page 4 of the CS that we have, which is / L or Lima.
Okay. That's right. I mean, that's where some of their changes are. The other major changes, there's a section towards the end of the Act where they talk about coordination with the medical examiner. And I'm looking at that. It's on my page 18. It's section 1352-255. Cooperation between coroner, state medical examiner, and procurement organization.
Okay, and are you saying that is or is not based on the Model Act?
Well, that is based on the Model Act, but it has been tweaked to, because we have a medical examiner model, for example, in Alaska. Some other states have coroners and so on. And so we did make some minor tweaks to take into account, for example, the vast distances in Alaska. I mean, doing donations, we have to fly to Nome or Bethel or something like that. I mean, we made some accommodations and some changes to acknowledge the vast jurisdiction of the medical examiner and the limitations that he has on what he can do and his services. And then we took those minor tweaks back to the National Conference of Commissioners and the original drafters, and they signed off on those changes, which, again, were minor and benign.
Thank you, Mr. Garrity. Further questions for Mr. Garrity? I don't see any. I've got one other person signed up that wants to testify, and that's Sherry Badillo Marino from Life Alaska. Are you on the phone, ma'am?
I am.
If you go ahead and state your name for the record and your affiliation, we'd be happy to hear from you.
Hi, my name is Sherry Badillo Moreno, and I am a volunteer with Life Alaska, and I am a donor mom. And I have spoken before. I'm not sure if it's to the same committee or not, so I do apologize if some of you have already heard my testimony. But
no, this is new to us, ma'am.
Oh, okay, all right. Like I said, I'm a donor mom, and my daughter, Sharday Badillo, was 17 years old when on November 23rd, 2003, the day before Thanksgiving, she was a senior at Colony High School. She had been their football manager for 4 years, and she was on her way to work, less than 1 mile from home, which is probably, as most of you know from statistics, which is where most accidents do happen. She was rounding the corner. We live in the Mount Sioux Valley here. And she lost control of her vehicle. And bless her heart, she hit the only large tree out here. The only blessing in this is that her passing was instant. In an instant, my daughter was gone. She was 17, like I had said. And it was over. She was very tiny, and she became a tissue and organ donor. What I've learned, I have been volunteering with Life Alaska since I lost my daughter, and when the passing is instant, you cannot become an organ donor. So Sharde was a tissue, heart valve, skin, and bone donor. My daughter has helped 48 people across this country, from a six-year-old boy to a 65-year-old woman. Her heart valve would become life-saving to either an infant or a young child. Her skin has been used in, and documented, has been used in burn and reconstructive surgeries. Her bone and tissues could be in joint or back surgeries. Sharde, like I said, had been the football manager at Colony High. The football players were her pallbearers, and the football coaches were part of her service. She was a nationally published poet. She had written a poem when she was 12 years old for her sister, who was almost killed out here on the Glen Highway when her sister hit a black bear, which is pretty crazy out here. The poem was called Cherish the Moments, and it spoke about living each moment to the fullest and not taking anyone in your life for granted, because you never know when someone will be here or someone will be gone in a moment. And just realizing that you'll never get to make that moment up, that no matter how much you regret something, you can never take it back. And she was only 12 years old when she wrote that. Sharde was very wise beyond her years, and ironically, her sister read that poem at her own service. Sharde loved unconditionally, and I remember after going through a number of years of therapy with her, my therapist asked, "What lesson did Sharde teach you?" And without thinking, I said, "She taught me to love unconditionally." And when Life Alaska called me to ask about tissue and organ donation, I didn't hesitate. I knew that's what my daughter would want, and that is part of why I continually offer to help and to encourage others to consider tissue and organ donation, because it has helped me and her sister immensely to move forward and to encourage others, because I know in my heart and soul that Sharde continues. She's out there. She's helping others, and if there's any way that we can encourage others. And I do want to share with you, especially about this act that's before you right now. Sharde and I had never really fully discussed tissue and organ donation. A few weeks after she had passed, I went up into her bedroom, and I was crying, of course. And in her windowsill in her bedroom, there was one of those little plastic cups her friend had gotten her from Las Vegas. And in the center, all those little goofy cards, you know, the teenagers have in their wallets, you know, those little silly cards. In the very center, somehow she'd gotten a card. And it was a tissue and organ donation card, and Sharde had signed it. So what that did for me as a grieving mother, it solidified my decision for tissue and organ donation for my daughter, and it gave me some closure that I had done the right thing, even though I knew in my heart that I had. And so that is part of what I tell everybody that I come into touch with. Share your wishes with your family. Do not leave your family out there hanging, wondering if they had done the right thing. It is so important to talk about it with your family, with your kids, with your friends, with total strangers, with anybody that you can. Let them know what your wishes are. And I recently, 8 weeks ago, became a donor daughter as well. My father, Forrest Hayden, an old-time gold miner up here in Alaska and a Rotarian for 45 years, had a massive stroke 3 days before his 78th birthday, and he was so proud of Sharde and her being a tissue donor that he changed his stand, and he became one as well. And he's now helping others, and him and Sharde are now watching over us and helping others. So I wanted to share that with you as well. Thank you.
Ms. Badillo Marino, thank you. It's very moving, and we appreciate you taking the time to testify to us this afternoon.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Is there anyone else online who wants to testify on behalf of HB 196? Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on this bill? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony, and we'll Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and I just want to say a couple things on the record, mainly to my committee members. You know, you spend time in these meetings and in these halls, and you wonder if any of the stuff that you do makes a difference, and you hope it does. And this is one of those circumstances where I look down, and in 2004, when I passed the bill that created the Alaska Donor Registry, the little heart on your driver's license, I thought then that it was going to be something that would make a difference. And to see that over 330,000 Alaskans have joined it, and 800 to 1,000 new registrants are added each week, it's overwhelming to me. And there were a lot of people in this legislature who helped move that forward. And I think this bill right here is a step to continue those efforts. And I appreciate the testimony from the folks that have had it touch their family. And then with that, I also want to declare a conflict. My father is the founder and chairman of Life Alaska Donation Services, which is one of the groups that supports this bill. And so I guess I would ask to refrain from voting, or?
I'm going to note your conflict.
Okay.
I don't know that that's in order in committee, but we're going to recess to investigate Section 1. We'll find out if we have to, what we have to do with your request.
Okay.
But we'll find out. We're going to recess to a call of the chair for this Section 1. But I want to thank the sponsor for accommodating the two bills into one. I know that's a request that gets made a lot around the building this time of year, and it's you're gracious to do that. So thank you, Ms. Pearson.
Good legislation. So
let's set this bill aside for the time being, and take up next HB 354.
Why don't we just pull that first section out?
I'm tempted. I want to talk to Jay. Oh no. No, don't say that about this bill.
Organ donors don't want to die.
Ms. Moss, welcome to the committee this afternoon. HB 354 is before us. I don't think we have a CS. It's the bill that came to the committee. It's backslash M is the one I have. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed. Put yourself on the record and let us know what the bill does.
For the record, Reneva Moss, aide to Representative Coghill. Mr. Chairman and committee, this bill started out as a request from Department of Law and the Office of Children's Services to clarify some best practice that they were doing in state statute. And it also became a vehicle for a fix in contradictory language resulting in 18-year-olds being adopted. And then we folded in House Bill 377 from Representative Guerra, which I will also discuss. First of all, and the reason the department came to us, is there was some uncertainty in the language that dealt with the department subsidizing hard-to-place children. And the way the statute was written, it could have been interpreted that even if a child didn't have a special need at the time, the department would have to provide a subsidy. So the new language in this bill basically, first of all, turns the decision over to the department to adopt regulations to make sure that it is clear when a hard-to-place child, can receive a subsidy, and makes the decision more fair and equitable to everyone. Currently, that decision is left to the commissioner, and the decision would be through regulation now.
Can I interrupt you? Maybe you're about to explain, but before we go past this, can you just explain what that subsidy is and who pays for it and how much it is? I don't know much about this.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Subsidy for a hard-to-place child would be, what I was going to do is explain how it would be that you would have possibly a hard-to-place child subsidy where you didn't know that was a hard-to-place child, an infant at birth, for instance, who has no signs of a problem, but after the child turns a year or 2 years old or 3 years old, you see signs of FAS or other issues that the child is going to deal with possibly through childhood and up into adulthood. So this would allow the department to initiate a subsidy at that time to pay for medical costs and for assisting the foster parent, let's say, to take care of the child, but it couldn't exceed the rates for foster care right now. And this could include a child that's being adopted. The state could subsidize that adoption through Medicaid coverage and a subsidy that would not exceed the foster care subsidy limit. Does that explain it to you?
When you say foster care subsidy limit, you mean what we pay to foster parents to take children
that's
in?
That's correct, Chairman.
So that's the upper limit of what's available under this
correct.
Bill? I understand. Yes. Thank you. And what is that roughly, just for a figure?
I'll
ballpark me. Come within $100. I'm just wanting to.
I'm not really sure, Mr. Chairman. It seems like it's less than $1,000 a month, isn't it? Like 850 something in that category.
Thank you.
The second thing this bill does is, in House Bill 53, we passed legislation that allowed OCS to share confidential information with public officials and their employees. This clarifies that if a public official or an employee disclose that confidential information, they could be convicted of a misdemeanor.
And which section is that?
That's the, let's see.
Looks like Section 4.
Let me see here. Yes, it's Section 4. Third, in Sections 3 and 4, and this is common practice, but it's not in statute, this just clarifies that OCS can, like anybody else, change a child custody support order by administrative actions, not having to go to court. And OCS does this right now, but there is a conflict between the statute and the regulation, so we're just trying to make sure that both of them agree.
You can change a child custody, child support
child
order.
Child support order.
So you could, without having
if
to go
if the child was in state custody.
I see, in state custody.
Correct. Then OCS could get the support order changed through administrative review versus going to court.
Do I understand that to mean you're basically going to make the state pay a little more for the upkeep of the child?
No, Mr. Chairman.
That'd be coming from the parents.
That would be coming from the parents.
But because the child's in state custody, they've kind of lost their right to go to court and fight it. Is that the thinking? I'm just
no, Mr. Chairman. Child support enforcement already has the authority to change support orders through administrative review. However, state law, the state statutes don't clarify that that applies to OCS as well as anybody else.
No.
So this just clarifies it.
Brings you into the same standing as everybody else.
Right.
Thank you.
And then again, the two issues that came up after the departments came to us. One is an example of an 18-year-old in Fairbanks who had lived with his stepfather for 18 years, didn't know his father, had never seen his father. Because there was a conflict in language in state statute under notification for an adoption, because he was not 19, he was required to seek notification of the missing father. So this statute basically just changed that notification so that if you're 18 years old and you want to be adopted, you don't have to notify absent parents. It treats you like an adult, like anything else. And
once you become 18, you're emancipated and you can
correct
proceed with all the rights
correct.
And duties. Thank you.
And then the last thing this does, and because this is judiciary, you may want Department of Law to explain this to you in more legal jargon. This incorporates House Bill 377, which says very clearly that the state is civilly liable for actions of employees who are on duty and make decisions that result in the injury or death of a child in state custody.
That looks like Section 6?
Yes. And we have Susan Cox here from Department of Law if you want to talk about that in detail.
She says she's here for questions, and we may get to that. Let me just ask you if you have anything else on the bill.
No, Mr. Chairman. I would say Representative Coghill, this is an area that he is continually interested in strengthening, and he supports this bill.
Questions from the committee for Ms. Moss? Don't see any. Thanks so much for being here. I'm sure you'll be standing by. Ms. Cox, maybe you can come forward. Welcome to the committee.
My My name is Susan Cox. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here from the Department of Law.
Give us a whole bunch of legal jargon, please.
I'm afraid to. I am here only to speak to Section 6, as you might require any assistance with that. We did help redraft that with Representative Guerra's permission and agreement. He had introduced House Bill 377, which did attempt to create a Section B to existing statute 4710960. He permitted us to rewrite it, and it was then also included into this bill, and that's where we are today. We have no problem with Section 6, which simply states that there may be a common law action for negligence or a wrongful death action permitted against the state if a child in custody is injured or dies while in state custody. The preceding, or the what is in existing statute 4710960 is unchanged. It becomes a paragraph A, and simply states that the statutes in Title 47 themselves cannot form the basis for a civil action against the state. But B would clarify that a common law action or a wrongful death case would not be prohibited.
Thank you. And I take it that was done with the full consent and cooperation of the bill sponsor.
Yes.
Everybody's on board with that change. Further questions from Ms. Cox? I don't see any. Thank you. Well done.
Thank you.
Let me ask if there's anyone else, or if there's anyone online who wanted to testify on behalf of HB 354. Is there anyone else here in the room that wants to testify on behalf of this bill? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. And brings the bill before us. Is there a committee discussion or a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that CS for House Bill 354, version M, be moved from committee with individual comments and attached zero physical note.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Right. Can't hear, but no.
We outlast.
One more, but I don't see it from Chief.
Let's do the next one, and then we'll just go from there. Okay. Ms. Kieneman, welcome to the committee. You've guessed rightly that the next bill up is HB 331.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome. Please put yourself on the record and tell us about the bill.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Roses, and he does send his apologies for not being able to attend here today. House Bill 331 addresses four separate things. The first thing that House Bill 331 does is drops the penalty for failure to notify the DMV of a name or address change from a Class B misdemeanor down to a fine of $25. We thought that a Class B misdemeanor was a little excessive if you go out and get married and are off on your honeymoon and then get pulled over when you come back and it's after 30 days, you're charged with a Class B misdemeanor. So we thought that was a little excessive.
Senator Wilikowski wants to ask you about that.
Has anyone ever been convicted of that,
I don't know. Whitney Brewster is online with DMV, and she may be able to answer that.
Well, please.
Is there some sort of a mechanism if someone still doesn't update their license? I mean, I can envision a scenario where someone just says, I'm just not going to update my license four or five times, okay, $100. Right. Is there any kind of mechanism, hammer, to get them to do that? Or?
Not that this specifically addresses, but I don't know what the DM, like I said, Whitney Brewster is online, and she'll probably be able to answer that more directly.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Section 2 of the bill adds an affirmative defense clause. If you are charged with driving without insurance and you go to court, you can prove, show that you did in fact have valid insurance at the time, and that's, the judge would consider that an affirmative defense. Section 3 of the bill states if you don't have vehicle insurance, you're guilty of a Class B misdemeanor and a fine of at least $500. Currently, the only fine for driving without insurance is a license suspension of 90 days to a year.
Okay, you can see my quizzical look because I thought there's a more severe penalty for that violation. I'll have to take a look, but keep going.
Mr. Chairman, I know in the municipality, certain municipalities do impose different fines, but right now it's up to the municipalities for those.
I believe what you're saying. I'm just harking back to an earlier time when I had some more in-depth familiarity with these statutes, so I may be forgotten them, but I'll just double check. But keep going.
Absolutely.
And Senator Wilkowski has a question. Yes. I keep interrupting you.
So we're not changing that other provision. This is just something that we're adding on top of it. So their license will still be suspended.
Correct.
And then we're just adding.
And the last part of the bill, Section 4, changes the notification procedure. Right now, if you are in an accident, you have to show proof. Fill out a form that says, yes, in fact, you did have insurance at the time, and submit that to the Department of Motor Vehicles. If you fail to fill out that form, they send you a notice, and then if they don't hear back, they send you another notice, certified mail. If they don't hear back from you within 30 days, they suspend your license. Right now, they send the notice to the address that you have on file with DMV. And I know in some instances with college students and such, their physical address is different than their mailing address. And so what this says is that the DMV is allowed to send the notice to the address listed on the accident report.
And as I recall, there was at least one incident of someone losing their license for having had the notification mailed to an old address, and this provision would have you mail the notification to either the address the department has for the person, which is existing law, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But then it also adds the address shown on the report of the accident, which is going to be probably the best information because you're there with an officer right there, and you should be telling them the truth. If you fib to the officer, then tough luck, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Further questions from Ms. Keeneman about the bill? Quiet crowd. Ms. Brewster, you're online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Anything you want to add to the presentation we've had in the committee about HB 331?
Sure. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. The DMV supports HB 331 as it allows the DMV more flexibility in where license suspensions are sent, which increases the odds that the notices are getting to the proper individuals. Unfortunately, folks don't always change their address with the DMV, and what is listed on the accident report is sometimes more current. And as was discussed, the law currently reads that we're to send the notice to the address on record. This legislation allows us to send the notice to the most current address, whether it's what's on record or what's listed on the accident report. So to answer a specific question that was raised, no one has ever been convicted of a misdemeanor for not changing their address with the DMV. I know that Senator Wilkowski had another question, but I apologize I was unable to hear that. But I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Senator Wilkowski, any of your questions not addressed?
My only question was, does DMV need some sort of hammer if someone just simply refuses to change their address? Because currently it's a misdemeanor, which is certainly going to get your attention. And I agree, that's excessive. But if someone keeps not complying with the law third, fourth, fifth time, does that become an issue for you?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we likely wouldn't be aware that it was even happening.
Follow up?
No.
And Ms. Brewster, maybe you can settle my question about the penalties for driving without motor vehicle insurance. We're hearing here it's going to be a Class B misdemeanor. I thought there was an A misdemeanor on the books for that. Am I mistaken?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure of that.
Fair enough. Well, We'll set this bill aside. I intend to come back after we get one other thing. We're going to meet later this afternoon to clear up one other issue, which I think may be cleared up, but we're just going to double check, and I'll have a chance to check on that. It's just a five-minute consultation between me and the good old law books. Ms. Keeman, anything else you want to say?
No, sir.
Thanks so much for being here this afternoon. Let's take a short at ease. HB 333 and Representative Fairclough here. Welcome to the committee. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please put yourself on the record and let us know what your bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. My name is Representative Anna Fairclough. I represent, or I should say, I'm elected by District 17 to represent all of Alaska. HB 333 is an act relating to reporting of child pornography. And what it does is it actually expands who would be required to report. The internet has led to wonderful information being available from communities that are in the vast rural regions of Alaska to clear around the world. But leaving that opportunity open has also allowed an unparalleled opportunity to exploit children. And so as images become prolific inside of the internet environment, children are being exploited. And that exploitation goes on into their adult years as images continue to linger on the internet to be printed and passed on to other generations. And so children live in fear. What this legislation does, it actually expands to cellular services, to internet providers, and to those who actually repair the equipment. So it's not, certainly not simple, but it is something in a new technology that we need to address differently. With that, I'm here to answer questions.
Questions for Ms. Fairclough. Senator Terrio.
Line 12, to report it to the nearest law enforcement agency. Do you have in mind who you want that to be? We had some discussion on another bill the other day, whether that's not directly on point, but VPSO or the Anchorage Police Department, North Pole Police Department, or do you really want all the information to go to a particular level of law enforcement? Or?
I'm certainly open for an amendment. Representative Guerra brought forward the, an amendment or a proposed language to me that would say the nearest state, local state or federal authority, which I have no issue with one way or another. There was questions whether village patrol officers would be the right person, but truly it's seeking out law enforcement, and so it could be the village patrol officer would be the appropriate person to report to. Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Please.
For the record, we were contacted, and I'm trying to find we were contacted from a national organization advancing the business of technology, and they were suggesting that we might amend my bill to include reporting to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And what I talked to them about is I didn't want an or on the books for that. We really wanted it to go to our local authorities so that children would be protected as quickly as possible in the state of Alaska. And so for the record, he asked me to read something into it as to my intent, and then if there are further questions, I would take those from the chairman if
please
I might
proceed.
Read.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I want to acknowledge for the record that there has been an existing federal law passed in 1999, 42 U.S.C. 13032, already requiring internet service providers to report suspected child pornography through the Cyber Tips line of the National Center for Missing Children, NCMEC. NCMEC coordinates its law enforcement activities with both federal and local agencies. And the issue is the internet service providers have to report that, and by no means am I trying to make them a target in this legislation. And so that in such cases, I believe that as long as the providers of the internet services fully fulfill their existing federally mandated reports, they meet the requirements in HB 333. In other words, it's not a vehicle to go out and start a lawsuit with Microsoft or internet. That's not where I'm going. I want local law enforcement agencies to know where that computer is at inside of the state of Alaska and to act so that children are protected in a timely manner.
It's tempting to add a provision that requires anybody that ever sees this stuff to call the police, but I understand that Senator McGuire and I have pushed mandatory notification laws, and you can run into a buzzsaw of opposition. So it's just, I've answered my own question. If you want to comment on it, you feel free to.
Mr. Chairman, I just want you to know that while this issue was brought to me, this isn't something that is mine. Members in our community who currently work on electronic equipment have seen images, mm-hmm. and there is a concern that if all the field isn't level, that some people will report and others will not, and then somehow not do the right thing for a child that's placed in danger. And so this is from my community.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And
then Senator Wilikowski.
And through the chair. And just also, one of the bills I did years ago actually allows for forfeiture of the materials that you end up. And that was a kind of an absurd part of the law, too, that you could sort of see the material on the hard drive and the software, but couldn't get to it. And so just want to remind you about that as you're talking with the people who might be doing this reporting, that once you do it, law enforcement's allowed to forfeit it, to confiscate it, and they can learn a lot from it.
So. Good remark. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just 2 points, and I don't know if do we have Ledger Legal on the line?
No, I don't know that we do.
One is on that federal law that you mentioned and whether or not that has any sort of preemptive effect on the internet provision. And the other is on the issue of privileges, husband-wife privilege, doctor-lawyer privileges. If you take some photographs of an injury, for instance, and then you take it to your doctor on your digital camera and he's flipping through it and he sees some pornography, and does he have an obligation? If you take it to your lawyer, do they have an obligation? So I guess I'd just be curious to have some of those questions answered at some point.
Mr. Chairman, in reference to a detailed explanation of what unlawful exploitation is, that's referenced in 1141455, and I believe I've provided that to you for what the specific pictures would be in regards to pornography. If I understand the question correctly, if someone else besides the people that are listed there would be mandated to report it, they are not.
Well,
it's unfortunate, but...
The way I read this, a person providing either privately or commercially film, photo, or visual or printed matter processing, production, or finishing services. So, and I'm just thinking of a situation, you bring your camera into your lawyer, for instance, and then they, you have all your digital pictures in there, and then they're flipping through it and they see it. And they're, I mean, I guess you're taking it in to have them print out, and so does that become a film, printed matter processing? I guess I'd be interested to hear what legal had to say about that.
Ms. Fairclough, response?
No response.
Why don't we do this? I think we're going to recess for about an hour while we look into a couple little minor matters. We'll hold this bill over. And then when members come back, if you would bring SB 305, a campaign finance bill, and HJR 28, the CBR into the PUMV idea, we can take those up later this afternoon. So let's, Ms. Fairclough, thank you. Let's recess to a call of the chair. We're back on the record. It's 4:40, still on April the 7th. And we are going to take up now CS for House Joint Resolution number 28. Ms. Hay, welcome to the committee.
Thank
you,
Senator.
On the record.
For the record, Linda Hay, staff to Representative Ralph Samuels, who is on the floor at the moment, so unfortunately he cannot be here.
I understand he's busy. We've got a couple of our colleagues who are in the same position. Mm-hmm. But we do have a quorum. Senator Huggins is here, Senator Terrio, myself, Senator French. We brought the bill up, or the resolution back up, because we had a good 1.5 hour. Senator McGuire's joined us. We've had a 1.5 hour hearing on it just a couple days ago, and fleshed out some of the economic and philosophical issues around the resolution. I have two that I just want to put on the record for myself. It's an interesting idea. I think it does need to advance to the next committee. My reservations are two. One's sort of philosophical and one is practical. Philosophical one is, you know, how rich is government supposed to grow? How much money should government sort of sock away? In a taxing state, I moved here from Colorado, and I went to their website, and they taxed last year $18 billion and wound up spending only $17 billion. Their tax receipts went up unexpectedly. What they're going to do next year is get those tax receipts back down, because you're reaching out and grabbing money out of people's pockets. If we were reaching out and grabbing money out of people's pockets to do this idea, we'd never get away with it. Mm-hmm. But we do live in a resource state where we should save some, because we recognize that the resource is not infinite. So, you know, you can debate that. The more practical issue I have with this revolves around what's going to happen in the future. At some point in the future, we're going to need to reach in. I think we all recognize we're going to need to reach in and probably get this money back out. Mm-hmm. Let me put it another way. At some point in the future, the 5% payout won't be enough to sustain government. We'll need more money. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we as lawmakers will be presented with a choice. Mm-hmm. We can either go to Alaskans and say, I need some tax money from you, or I can reach in here and get this money out of the strong box. And I just have a very hard time believing that we as a body will have the wherewithal to say, I'm going to tax you, despite the fact there's a bunch of money over here in this strong box mm-hmm. that we put away for a rainy day. And so I think what's going to happen is we'll ride the pony up, and then when the pony comes back down to where we need the money again, we're just going to undo this and reach in and get the money. So that's my view. Any other community discussion on the matter? Senator McGuire, Senator Huggins, Senator Terrio, I guess we're ready for a motion then.
Mr. Chairman, but at some later date, reaching in and getting the money, if in fact it was set up, is maybe easier said than done. I mean, it would take a constitutional amendment. So I don't know that you'd necessarily just reverse it and take the cash.
But I think procedurally what you'll do is you'll send the resolution, we'll at least send the resolution out for approval by the people, right, before we tax them. Say, do you want to be taxed, or do you want the money out of the strong box? And I guess we'll see at that point what they say if the idea advances to that point. Senator McGuire.
Well, and my hope is, Mr. Chairman, is that the growth of government is controlled through all of it. And I think that was one of the main points that the sponsor made, was that, you know, left unchecked, you get into a situation through both your capital and your operating budget where you're on this path of unsustainability. And so my hope would be that we're not just reaching into a strong box, albeit it would be more difficult, as Senator Terrio said, but rather that we live within our means.
And the one of the slides that was very persuasive in the presentation was the relationship between a surplus and government spending.
Yeah.
You know, it looked like pretty much one-to-one correlation between us, you know, spending more money when we had it and not when we didn't. I had another thought, but I'm afraid at this hour in the afternoon, it slipped my mind. Yep. So, motion.
Yes. House Joint Resolution 28, version Oscar B. Move Committee. Individual comments as amended.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the resolution is moved from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Separate motion on fiscal notes, or does that include fiscal notes?
You want to amend it to a?
Yeah, to include fiscal notes.
With the attached fiscal notes, any objection? Again, hearing and seeing none, the entire package is moved from committee. This brings up HB 305, and you should have on your desks. Actually, let's just wait till we're not in so big a rush that we can't wait till the paperwork's done.
Are we going to go back and do the earlier bills too?
If we can get to them, yeah, before we run out of gas. This one will probably take about 5 minutes and then maybe 10. We'll see. All set? Okay, let's turn now to HB 305. You should have before you a CS, which is / Oscar. If someone would move that, I'll then object and we'll discuss it.
I'll move Oscar.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion. The CS before you makes two changes. Both have been run past the sponsor, and I believe they are, in fact, one was brought to us by the sponsor and the other was my suggestion. The suggestion I made was to remove references to federal offices inside the CS. It just struck me that the legal precedent is so far beyond debate that it was I don't want to say waste of time, but it was just, to me, it was just clearly going to be money spent by the state to defend a statute that was going to ultimately wind up yielding no positive results. And so based on that position, the sponsor's been kind enough to say, okay, let's avoid that fight. The other change we made was that every time the bill said location outside the capital city, we changed that to say municipality other than a capital city. And that was a suggestion brought to us by the sponsor, just to make it a little more meaningful for Ledge Legal or Ledge Ethics or somebody to figure out what it is you're talking about when you say location. Is a location a mile, 5 miles, 20 miles, what is it? And so those are, in essence, the two changes made to the CS. Mr. Pawlowski, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. I just wanted to add to the chairman's statement on the record that the change suggestion on location was actually brought to the sponsor by the Legislative Ethics Committee as their concern for how they would interpret the statute as it was going to be written. And the sponsor supports both changes.
With that, I'm going to remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Is there further objection? Hearing and seeing none, the CS is before us. The CS continues, in my view, to operate in areas where I have constitutional qualms. They're not strong enough to bottle the bill up, but they are. I just need to put them on the record. I don't know that. Well, I guess we'll find out whether you can do what you can propose to do in this bill. I mean, I'm not a Supreme Court justice. I don't know what they're going to say. I have qualms. I can't. That's about as good as I can get. It's an extremely tricky area of law. There's a welter of opinions and cases on this topic, and you can really get lost in the weeds. And so I think it's beyond me to say, flatly, this is unconstitutional. I felt strongly about the federal office. The other matters I have suspicions about, but not so strong as to bottle the bill up in committee. I did have the thought, and I may have expressed it last time. It seems to me that the real issue here, and I was going to bring down and read a bunch out of Buckley versus Vallejo, but they really went on and on about disclosure. Because disclosure really seems like the heart of the matter. And as they said in Buckley, that is the least restrictive manner in which you can impose some kind of a time, place, or manner restriction on someone's ability to participate in the marketplace of ideas. And I really got gripped by the idea that if you just disclosed on a regular basis, every 7 days, say, during session, every month during the rest of the year, you can raise money whenever you want to. I mean, this bill, frankly, lets you raise money in Anchorage, hop on a plane, come to the Capitol, and vote on a big bill, which I think most people would say that's absurd. On the other hand, my view is if you disclose that 24 hours later, the voters could at least know what's going on. But that's just a qualm of mine about the approach taken here. But again, this is one of those issues that people wrangle over for months and years. Senator McGuire, you had something you want to say?
Is that Buckley v. Vallejo?
Yeah, that's the original. That's the original Supreme Court campaign free speech case. Senator Terrio.
So your example of hopping on the plane, is that only within 90 days?
Yes. Okay. Yes. This maintains the flat prohibition on fundraising during legislative session, unless that session is within 90 days of an election. Is that right, Mr. Paul?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. For your own personal race for office.
Right. But, you could see, even in this year, if for some reason we get extended, something happens, they have a breakdown in the governor's office, they can't make the recommendation until, September 19th, and there we are in the heat of an election season, and I can promise you there will be people raising money in Anchorage for their elections and flying down here to vote on the gas line. But with a little luck, we'll avoid it. Senator Terrio.
And so if we're within that 90 days, individual legislators are able to raise money for their campaigns, but are they prohibited from signing on as a host to raise money in somebody else's campaign?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, that's correct. Okay.
Thank you.
Further questions for the bill's sponsors?
Mr. Chairman, if I actually might correct something I just said, there is a nuance to that, Senator Terrio, through the chair. If a representative or a senator was in a joint fundraiser with another representative or senator, that would be permissible, because even though it's a joint fundraiser, it's still a fundraiser for themselves and not for someone else.
Yeah. Thank you.
Subtle nuance, but sponsor thinks it's important, Mr. Chairman.
Further committee discussion? Good question. I don't think there's a, there must not be, because I don't think there's a finance referral. Is that, Mr. Pulaski, is that right?
It's a single zero.
Single zero fiscal note.
APOC.
From APOC, just for the record. Does that comport with your understanding?
Mr. Chairman, that does. And we asked for the APOC fiscal note because of the adjustment to 15-13-072 in section one of the bill.
Follow up based on that, Senator Huggins. The bill is before us, so ready for a motion.
I move that CS for House Bill 305 version Oscar be moved from committee with attached zero fiscal note.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Pulaski. Good job.
Put in a good word for us.
Let's just do the other one and then call it good. Yep. Yep. And that is, your bill number is?
331.
That's the next bill up.
Okay.
331, we had a little colloquy in the hallway over the penalties to be imposed for a for driving without insurance. I think I was right. Ms. Kieneman, you have to say it.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Roses. And, yes, you were right. Driving without insurance is a unclassified misdemeanor. But yes, it's still a misdemeanor. And it's a person is punishable. It's punishable by a fine of not more than $500 or by imprisonment for not more than 90 days or by both.
Right. So it's unclassified in the statute books now. We're going to make it a B misdemeanor here, impose a minimum $500 fine. And I think that's a reasonable approach. People who drive without insurance frequently do so for economic reasons. Nevertheless, hitting them with a $500 penalty and the possibility of some jail time seems about right. As we discussed off the record before the hearing began, 9 out of 10 of these cases get dropped in exchange for someone actually going and buying a policy. And so, you know, that's the idea, is to get them a policy, not to put them in jail, not to penalize them further. We want people driving with insurance, not otherwise. So that seems like a good approach. The bill is otherwise before us. I don't think we had anybody sign up to testify. Is there anybody who wants to testify on HB 331? Anybody online? Hearing and seeing none, that puts the bill before us in a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for House Bill number 331, individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So this one's done, 305. And I don't think I see we've got one left to do. I'm going to hold 333 over till tomorrow. We've told the sponsor that's the internet bill.
Yeah.
I want to find out how they can get a misdemeanor for that crime, and I get a violation on murder.
Yeah.
It's just... need to hear from the Department of Law a little bit more. She's on her way.
We could always amend it.
I'm just gonna. Yeah, I just want to do a little more head shedding on that. Still got plenty of time, actually. Doing the signatures on. Yep.
So what's the other one you want to take up today?
This is the estate bill and the anatomical gift. That's number
196.
196. Mark, I've got to vote something. Let's see, this is vehicle license. This is vehicle license. It's the one we just did. Mm-hmm. Okay, refresh your recollection.
Recollection refreshed.
Perfect timing. We are just turning to HB 196. And I understand after our discussion regarding Section 1 that you conferred with the interested parties, and they and the sponsor are willing to have Section 1 dropped. Is that correct?
Chair French, that is correct.
So I'm going to, at this point, move Amendment Number 2, and Amendment Number 2 would be to delete Section 1, otherwise referred to in the bills as Lines 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, and to renumber the sections accordingly. Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, Amendment Number 2 is adopted, which puts the bill back before us in its entirety. Further committee discussion regarding the bill.
Mr.
Senator Terrio.
What was Amendment Number 1?
Amendment Number 1, we changed $100,000 to $50,000.
Oh, that's right.
On page 2, line 10.
Okay.
With that clarification, Senator McGuire.
I move that we move Senate CS for House Bill Number 196 as amended today, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. With that, we're going to stand in recess to a call the chair, but not today. We might have to meet tomorrow. The concurrent resolution. Need a motion to move the concurrent resolution that goes with HB 196.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the Senate concurrent title resolution to accompany the House Bill 196 out of Senate Judiciary.
Any objection to that motion? Then the hearing and seeing none, the concurrent resolution is moved, and we are again adjourned to a call this.